So I've been gradually teaching metta meditation during the whole of this range retreat, trying to show little bit the different aspects of this practice. It's a meditation which is, it's often like one of our first points of entry or our first ideals when we come to Buddhism, or really any spiritual practice, is the simple recognition of the power of compassion, of caring, of loving kindness, and kind of the desperate need for that and need for more of that in the world. And so wanting to engage with and deepen one's own practice or deepen one's own perspective on life through a conscious engagement and working with a philosophy, a way of life that emphasizes and encourages this so much. So for many people, this is one of the kind of immediate, very primary things that make them interested in Buddhism. So that's all good. And very often when we come to the first meditation class or Dhamma class or something, and we're taught maybe the Metta chant, we maybe chant the Metta Sutta like we have done just now, or we do some of the other Metta chants that are very popular, Hansukito Homi, Avero Homi, and so on, which have been so beautifully recorded and so on these days, and you can get them on CDs, and people like to listen to them when they're sitting in traffic jams and all of these kinds of things. So it's a very kind of popular practice. And in the like in the youth groups, in it's very popular in the Southeast Asian Buddhism. They have these youth groups and so on, and usually all the young men do lots of metta for all the young women. All the young women do metta for lots of the young men, and lots of nice Dhamma romances coming out of that. I heard about another Dhamma romance coming from a Buddhist youth group just the other day. So those things are quite common. So it's maybe not the best way to meditate, but it's certainly not a bad way to meet somebody. And, you know, if you do start out, if, you know, you do have that kind of sort of genuine caring and love for somebody as the beginning of a relationship, it's pretty good, isn't it? Normally we come to a relationship with such sort of needing and grasping and so on. So these are all different ways that this practice of metta manifests in Buddhist culture and Buddhist communities. And they're all good, and they're all part of the, what it, you know, the different ways that Buddhist teachings find expression, find meaning in people's lives. However, what I've been teaching here, this range retreat, really is not any of these things, or rather it encompasses these things and goes beyond them. And that's what I'm trying to emphasize and trying to show, that this practice of metta is not merely something which leads to, you know, happiness and peace of mind for oneself. It's not merely something which makes us more happy in our relationships and our family and so on. It's not merely something which can lead to peace and harmony in society and in the world. It's not merely something which is a beautiful idea and an uplifting philosophy. It is all of these things, but it's also something much deeper. So in this practice of metta, we learn to systematically and very carefully develop metta in our hearts in a way which will hopefully, or will ideally, reveal the true face of metta, or reveal the kind of the naked reality of loving kindness in our heart. And this is where the practice is leading to. This is what I want to try to encourage you and guide you towards, point towards, so that we can experience these things. And as we've been settling in for the Rains Retreat, you know, we're nearly two-thirds of the way through the Rains Retreat now. You've all had time to see how things are going, ups and downs, comings and goings, changes in the community, more quiet times, more busy times, and so on. And about this time in the range retreat, it's customary to look back and think, oh my goodness, I've just wasted 2 months, what am I doing with my life? This is kind of normal, so don't worry about it. So, and time to remember that it's fast running out, so we've got to redouble our efforts for the next period. So finally, in this practice of metta, working little bit by little bit, step by step, I've come up to the stage of developing metta for a disliked person, the fourth stage. And we've been spending a lot of time on the first three stages, metta for oneself, a loved one, and a neutral person. And now we're to really go for that most difficult, that most subtle, that most powerful of stages of metta, where one tries to put into practice those words which Jesus said so succinctly, love thy enemy. So now that's what we're going to try and do. So I want you to prepare for that now, just by thinking of, in your mind, just think of one person who can fit into each of these categories. One person who's a loved one person who's neutral to you, someone who you don't know very well, don't have much feelings for one way or the other, and then one person who you dislike, someone who gets on your nerves. Okay, so I want you to think of one person in each of those categories now, before we start practicing, and then when we do the meditation, then that person will come to mind easily for you. Okay? Okay, so everyone now please get ready for meditation. And bring our mind into the present moment. Hearing the sounds of the wind outside. Noticing the feelings all through the body. Of energies, tension, pain in parts of the body, feelings of lightness or ease, resting mind in the heart region. Bring up the words of metta. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Repeating the words evenly, carefully, clearly. You keep the words in the heart. Notice that along with the words also comes the feeling of metta. A very soft inner glow. So gentle and tender. feeling becomes more clear and stable. Gradually let it spread out until it's soaking through your whole body, moving from the top of the head, gradually down through all parts of the body, until you can feel every cell from the surface of the skin to the marrow of the bones soaked through and suffused with loving kindness. Can feel the metta through your whole body, and we can move to the second stage, loved one. You don't move our minds, you don't go anywhere else. We keep our mind soaking through the whole body. The mind soaking through. We just change the name of the person in the words of metta. May that loved one be happy. Putting their name in the phrase that we recite to ourselves. For example, if I choose my father, may my father be happy. May my father be happy. May my father be happy. Or whoever you've chosen for that loved person. May they be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. Keep keeping the mind rested and centered on that whole body awareness. To the third person, just the same way, keeping one's mind contained in the body. May that third person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. fourth person. May that disliked person be happy. May that disliked person be happy. May that disliked person be happy. Keeping the mind clearly focused in the body. Keeping one's mindfulness centered. Not letting the mind stray out to thoughts about that person. Keeping one's energy focused and resolved. May that disliked person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. coming back down through each of the stages, from the dislike person to the neutral person. May that neutral person be happy. And to the loved one, may that loved one be happy. And to oneself, may I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. And letting the words of metta go, letting the feeling of metta fade away. Allowing the mind to come back to a sense of neutral, open space. A couple of minutes to review over the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. What was going on? What happened? How did that meditation go? How did my mind change? Different stages did the meditation go through? Was I able to stay with the meditation? What was it that made my mind drift off? We can dedicate the merits. May all beings be happy, may all beings be safe, may all beings rejoice in the merit we made through our practice. May all beings finally attain Nibbana. Sadhu. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa sambuddhassa aparota te sangamata sadvara yeso tonto panchantu sadhanate. So today we come to the seven enlightenment factors, the second last of the groups of dhammas that compose the 37 factors in enlightenment. As I think I mentioned sometime earlier, these groups are not sequential in any sense. It's just like a conventional order. So we don't need to think about them in terms of like a progressive development of each set of these dhammas. Rather, within the set of dhammas, there is a sequence and an order, but not in the overall set of 37 as a whole. So what we have with the 37 Wings to Awakening is like a summary or an overarching classification of the main teachings on practice according to the Buddha, and each of which has its own particular aspect, its own particular quality. So these factors of enlightenment, Vajanga, are so called because they lead to enlightenment, lead to Nibbana. The suttas are quite explicit on that point. They say that they mention this quite clearly, that this is why the Bodhijangas are called that, because they lead to enlightenment. In the later Abhidhamma explanation of these, they came to be termed more as, or understood more as, aspects of the experience of enlightenment. So the Bodhijangas were understood as being various mental factors that were present in the mind of someone who is actually being enlightened. And which is, in my opinion, is rather missing the point. It's not supposed to be an analysis of the experience of enlightenment. Basically, who cares what happens in the mind of someone at the time they're being enlightened? As long as they're enlightened, who cares what mental factors are absent or present at that time? What these are a teaching of the path, which is how to get there. And that's what's important. Very commonly, when the Buddha just talked of these factors, we have in the Pali, a very nice series of dhammas that's associated with each one. It says, for example, one develops each of these enlightenment factors. It says, viveka nisitam, dependent on seclusion. Viraga nisitam, dependent on dispassion. Nirodha nisitam, dependent on cessation. Vosagga parinami, and ripening in relinquishment. These are very beautiful dhammas. They're very profound dhammas, ones which are not easy to understand from the worldly perspective. Why are we, when we're people who delight in company, we delight in society, why should we want to practice something that's dependent on seclusion? When we're people who delight in our desires, delight in our wishes, delight in getting what we want, why should we want to practice something which is dependent on dispassion? When we are people who delight in birth, we delight in giving rise to things, we delight in things that are new, why should we practice something which is dependent on cessation? Vosagga parinami, ripening and relinquishment, and letting go. This is where these things are leading to, not to getting stuff, but to letting them go. Like this, similar to this paradoxical phrase I mentioned last week in the context of the five indriyas. Vosaggaramanankaritva labhati samadhi labhati cittasekaggatam. Dependent on relinquishment, one gains, or relying on relinquishment, one gains samadhi, one gains one-pointedness of mind. So that this letting go, by letting go you get samadhi. So when the Buddha was talking about getting samadhi, he used the word labhati, which literally means getting things. Like what you get, used in the same sense, is labha, is what just the stuff that you have, belongings and things. So it's literally like get samadhi, you get one pointedness of mind. But that getting comes from letting go. So because of letting go, because of not having anything, that's how you get what you want. So all this kind of paradox is all kind of embodied in the very phrases the Buddha is using to talk about the Dhamma. So this practice of the Bodhijangas is quite consciously aimed to go contrary to the world. It's targeted to go against the stream of what we think of as valuable in the world. The Buddha used these terms quite deliberately in this way to challenge us. If we come to it from worldly values, we're we just look at that and we go, oh, what are we going to do that for? Why are we going to practice that? But when we come to it from a dhammic perspective, we see these things are just so beautiful. It's just so beautiful to be secluded physically, to be secluded mentally. It's just so lovely. It's just so beautiful to be free of wishes and to be free of desires, rather than just wandering around following our desires all the time. So beautiful to see the ending of things. Instead of heaping up more and more, getting, building things, making more things, just the quiet ending of things, watching them fade away. And all of this ripening and relinquishment. How could anything be more lovely? How could anything be more attractive, more tantalizing? So this list of the seven bhujangas starts out with mindfulness. Mindfulness, an investigation of dhammas, energy, rapture, tranquility, samadhi, and equanimity. So mindfulness is the first one. Mindfulness isn't always the first in these groups of dhammas. If we look, for example, if you remember the indriyas we talked about last week, in that one, mindfulness was the middle factor. So as the middle factor, the middle one of a group of five, we can understand the role of mindfulness there as being like a balancing. So it's mindfulness which balances all the other factors. So faith and wisdom, the balance of faith and wisdom is achieved by mindfulness. And also energy and samadhi are balanced by mindfulness. Too much energy, the mind becomes scattered. Too much samadhi, then the mind becomes thoughtful. So mindfulness is the one that balances these five faculties. Here in the bhujangas, however, mindfulness isn't presented in the same way, so it's not emphasizing that aspect of balancing of mindfulness, but is more emphasizing the aspect of initiating. It's mindfulness which stands at the beginning and which sets off these seven bhujangas. When we see the way the Buddha chose to describe these, there was a close connection between this first factor, mindfulness, and the second one, dhammavicaya, investigation of dhammas. And it's important to recognize that both of these are used in two senses. The first sense is the more mundane, the more everyday sense. In that sense, sati stands for memory, and dhammavicaya stands for investigation of the teachings. So in that sense, it's described like somebody hears the teachings and then they remember it. When they can remember the teachings, then they think about them, investigate them with wisdom. So this is a very normal, everyday sense of these terms. Not necessarily very common. A lot of the time people hear the teaching, go sadhu, sadhu, but if their mindfulness isn't strong, then they don't remember anything from it. They don't take away anything from it. And so they can't investigate. But you know that in Buddhism, traditionally, one's always supposed to memorize the teachings, and this is the basis for investigation. So it's very good, even if we've lost the knack of being able to actually fully memorize a Dhamma talk which is being given, nevertheless, it's good to practice by memorizing some suttas. And maybe a little bit later in the Rains Retreat, I'll prepare some Pali passages and so on, which I'll share with you and encourage you to memorize as part of your practice. So the second aspect of mindfulness is the one which is perhaps more familiar to us, and the one which is more directly relevant to Dhamma or to meditation practice, and that is the aspect of present moment awareness. And so one is able to bear in mind, to recollect, to focus one's awareness on what's happening in the present moment. And this becomes the basis for that investigation of dhammas. One can then investigate, inquire as to what is actually going on. There's an unusual aspect of these bhujangas, as I mentioned earlier, that these sets of dhammas are within themselves are quite carefully structured. That is, there is a progressive sequence. Usually in these progressive sequences we find the wisdom factor is at the end. So when we saw, for example, the four iddhipadas, the four bases of psychic power, then vimamsa is at the end, the wisdom factor. And the five spiritual faculties also, panya, wisdom, is at the end of those five faculties. But here, Dhamma Vichaya is near the beginning. So here, the reason for this seems to be that when we look at how these things are described in the suttas, because they are described in these two ways, one is that more the theoretical way of memorizing and investigating the teachings, the other is the more immediate experiential way of bringing present moment experience to mind, bearing it in mind and investigating that. Now when the Buddha talked about the seven bhujangas as a sequence, as a series, one following the next, then invariably we find it's that first sense which is talked about, that one hears the teaching, memorizes it, investigates the teaching, and then that gives rise to energy, because you're investigating, thinking about the teaching, and that gives rise, the energy gives rise to rapture, the rapture to tranquility, the tranquility to samadhi, the samadhi to equanimity, and thus one develops these seven bhujangas. So in that context, when they're talking about the progressive development, then it's the more theoretical side of mindfulness and investigation of dhammas which is meant. And this again corresponds to a very a fundamental, important part of our understanding of the structure of the Dhamma, that we start out with a theoretical understanding, like the kind of understanding that you can all get by listening to this talk this evening. And then through the development of meditation, making our mind peaceful, development of samadhi, then that theoretical understanding will ripen and deepen into a direct experiential vision of the truth. Okay, so it's in that preliminary theoretical sense that the wisdom factor is mentioned at the beginning of the seven bhujangas. When we come to talk next week about the Eightfold Path, we'll also see a similar pattern at work there. So these are things to be developed. Mindfulness, bearing in mind, both in terms of memorizing the teachings, memorizing the suttas, memorizing the main structure and doctrines that the Buddha taught, and also bearing those in mind and investigating them. This is something to be developed. And also bearing in mind one's present moment experience, investigating that. This also is something to be developed. There is this Dhamma Vichaya does have an active sense to it. It's not merely just a still watching of things, but it implies a more kind of active investigation, inquiry, analysis of experience. When you're doing that, if you're taking up, for example, sense activity, and you're analyzing the different experiences, the different kinds of consciousness in the senses, splitting them up from each other, and seeing them in their own quality, then as you do that, it takes work in the mind. And this work of the mind creates energy. So this is one of the ways that we use to develop energy. So if you find that your meditation is sloppy or slack or just lazy, then do some of this Dhamma Vichaya. That doesn't mean just sort of think, sit there and think randomly about the Dhamma. But you have to like choose and focus your mind in some kind of framework. If your samadhi is already very good, you don't need to worry about it too much. Your mind will naturally incline to investigate and you can just let it go according to its own flow. But when the mind is not yet been purified through samadhi, then you need to like narrow your focus, choose some technique or some method or some framework that you can use to focus on experience and structure your investigation. So you can choose any one of the Dhamma or wisdom categories or frameworks that the Buddha talked about, the three characteristics, or the five aggregates, or the four noble truths, and so on, and or the dependent origination, and use them as like a framework. Try and investigate these teachings in your experience. And as you investigate them, then try to learn what's the relationship between your experience and the kind of the literal word, the theoretical teachings. This is like an aspect of Dhamma Vichaya. So that in and of itself, don't mistake that, in and of itself, this is not deep wisdom. This is not the truth. This is just a technique or a training of the mind which is helpful to giving rise to wisdom. The real wisdom just comes by itself. Okay, you can't tell it when to arise or not. But you can do this kind of investigation which will be conducive, it will be helpful for arising of wisdom. And as you do that, your mind gets energy because you're doing the work. And the Buddha said, don't do too much samadhi practice. If you just do samadhi all the time, your mind will be slothful. And so, just like the fire, when the fire is burning low, and it's almost out, and then you need to throw some very dry fuel on it to burn it up and make it go hotter. So this is what we're doing here. When the fire is too low in the mind, burn it up with some energy. Fire it up, get it going. Rouse yourself up with like a feeling of urgency about the Dhamma. Investigate those very disturbing teachings, things, teachings of death, teachings of the terrifying fears of samsara. Give like urgency into your mind. And when you can do that, then that feels good. Makes you feel happy because you're working hard. You can see that as well, can't you? Even in just in an everyday sense. If you're in the monastery, if you need to do some work for the community or for the monastery, it makes you feel good. Even though we like to complain about it, but actually it's good to do work. It feels good. It's much better than just lying around being thoughtful all the time. And if we don't, you know, we notice that, because what happens if we don't do it? What happens if other people are working and then we don't? And we, of course, we feel very bad. Unless we've got some good reason to, but if it's just through our laziness that we're not working, we're not helping, that makes us feel terrible. Yeah? So this is how you can see that putting forth that effort actually is very joyful. It's the same in your mind. If you actually put forth your effort in your meditation, strive, then it feels good. You make you happy. It makes you like a sense of joy in your mind. And this joy is what we call piti. Of course, not the English word piti. Piti. We usually translate as rapture, uplift. So we've already talked about this in a few contexts in the talks this rains retreat. And of course, piti being one of the jhana factors also. So we understand, my understanding of piti is that piti is essentially one's emotional response to a pleasant feeling. So there's a feeling of pleasure, a vedana, pleasant feeling. And how do we respond to that? We respond to that with a sense of elation. Sense of rapture, a sense of uplift. So we can distinguish those things, can't we? Like if somebody cooks an especially nice dish for the lunchtime and we have like a sense of excitement about eating it, we can distinguish that excitement about eating that food from the actual pleasure of eating it. There's two different things. This one is like the physical pleasure, it's a feeling of vedana, and then the other thing is our emotional response to that. So piti is our emotional response to pleasant feeling. And it's a feeling of uplift. But piti in itself is neither good nor bad. It can be wholesome or unwholesome. But obviously in this context we're talking about wholesome piti, wholesome rapture. So in pointing to the importance of this factor, the Buddha was emphasizing again and again that how incredibly crucial it is that we have this kind of positive energy in the mind. It's another way of describing PD. It's just like a positive energy in the mind, a sense of interest. You don't have that there, your mind will just be dull and uninterested in the Dhamma, uninterested in anything. And so you can see that when people put too much emphasis on the negative side of the Dhamma, too much emphasis on just getting rid of desires, and too much emphasis on, you know, the world's rubbish and everyone's full of defilements, blah, 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 like this. And they don't have that sense of rapture in the mind. Something to be careful of. In the forest tradition in Thailand, sometimes, you know, when we read some of the teachings, they sound very kind of energetic and forceful. And if you read the teachings of monks like Ajahn Mahabua, for example, very, very forceful, powerful teachings. And telling us about the dangers of samsara and all of these kinds of things, and how we have to rouse up our energy to very kind of forcefully practice and overcome defilements and all of these kinds of things. But also remember that You know, these words are being spoken by somebody who's like a master at samadhi, master at wholesome, happy, joyful states of mind, and someone who's able to sit in these states of samadhi for basically as long as they want, and has been doing so for many, many, many years. So don't kind of mistake these teachings. Don't think that you know, to be able to see dispassion and to be able to get released from the world, that you have to have like a carry around an attitude of kind of dour negativity about things. This isn't Dhamma. This is not the way of real practitioners. When you see real practitioners, they always have a sense of lightness about them, a sense of joy, a sense of ease, a sense of emotional wholeness. So this is what in Pali is what we call piti. We develop this sense of emotional wholeness. It's like when we do the metta meditation, and I try to ask you to soak the metta through your whole body. And that time, there should be a sense of piti through that as well. A sense of uplift, so that you can almost like feel this energy body. You can feel, hold in your mind this shape of energy, which is this feeling of rapture and uplift in metta. So these are not like distinct things, this kind of the metta and the rapture and so on. We talk about them in different ways, but it's in experience, it's just like one experience. So that your aim in that practice through developing metta is to actually experience this rapture through your whole body, soaking through your body. Isn't that a wonderful thing for, you know, if we just think on the level of physical health, isn't that wonderful that, you know, you're spreading that positive energy? Surely that's going to be giving you tremendous health benefits, purifying the energies in your body. Certainly you feel, your body feels much, much lighter and more pleasant afterwards if you've been doing that for some time. So, you know, we talk a lot about this idea in our modern society that we feel like we're very, we use words like alienated to describe our emotional condition or our existential condition. When we think about these kind of terms, like when we talk about, say, existentialism, or, you know, it's like a philosophy, and it's a philosophy which has some very important things to say to us, and it's a philosophy which emphasizes what it means simply to be alive, to be here. And how do we come to grips with that? But of course, it's so difficult within that philosophical framework to actually stay with or stay close to our experience. In meditation, we're actually experiencing those things. So we're not just talking about ideas like alienation, or, you know, if we talk about like being kind of deconstructed, you know, we like to deconstruct everything. And so like our minds are like deconstructed, our minds are scattered, our consciousness is scattered everywhere. But normally we don't realize that. It's not enough simply to talk about these things, to talk about, say, the one, or talk about feeling of wholeness and all of these kinds of things. And they remain just like ideas and so on that we can experience just dimly. Maybe we can see them sometimes. If we go to walk in nature or something like that, and we can feel like this feeling of oneness or wholeness, it's more like a healing kind of sensation, and so on. But we're not experiencing it really deeply and really directly. And that's what we're trying to develop in a meditation, in the metta meditation. We're trying to heal ourselves, we're trying to heal all these fractures, we're trying to heal all these dislocations, we're trying to heal all these tensions, these contradictions, and to create like this one energy body, this one bliss body, which is fills the whole of our experience. So it's not just like our experience is just there, and then there's a bit of a feeling of oneness that's associated with it. But we want to immerse our consciousness completely within this feeling of oneness, so that our whole body becomes our one being. Our whole body and mind becomes our one being. This, of course, is the self, isn't it? This is like creating a building up ourselves. So this aspect of Dhamma practice is not that aspect of deconstructing things, of analyzing, of ripping out the essence of things, of showing that really nothing's worth anything. This isn't that aspect. This is that aspect of cherishing and holding and nurturing something until it's very beautiful and very delicate and very whole. We need to do this. We need to create this sense of a refined, whole self. You can go and deconstruct it later. That's not a problem. Don't worry about that. We're all so used to deconstructing stuff. It's not an issue for us. learn to do that. But we need to actually get that there in the first place. We need to make that so clear and so powerful and so strong that we can actually live in that, actually immerse in that experience of our whole body and mind as like one field of experience, one field of energy. And this is how we do it. We do it through developing this piti, this rapture as an enlightenment factor. When that rapture, that piti, is circulating through our whole body, energizing our whole body, vitalizing our whole body, then there's just like this field of bliss which you get, your mind can immerse into. When your mind immerses into that, the rapture will, as it goes on, become more and more subtle, more and more peaceful. And so this is when we tend to move from the piti or janga to pasadhi, tranquility. And in this sense, pasadhi or tranquility is very close in meaning to sukha or bliss. So in the jhana factors we have piti and sukha, whereas in the bodhihangas we have piti and pasadhi, rapture and tranquility. They're very close in meaning. And sukha is like almost slightly kind of rich, sweet feeling of bliss. And tranquility, pasadhi, is that stillness of mind, that settledness of mind that's associated with that. So as one's like immersed in that bliss body, whether practicing metta or practicing any other meditation, and immerses more and more in that feeling of that field of experience, that field of awareness, a concrete, like defined field of awareness, not a kind of vague, woofly thing that's all floating up in the clouds, but this actual body of experience, tranquilizing that until it's become so soft, and you realize how the energies in your body can work so with so much ease at resolving all the tensions, resolving all the dissonances in your body, until you have this feeling just ease right the way through. And of course that ease leads the mind to samadhi. It's not an arbitrary association of ideas here. We're seeing an unfolding of a natural psychology. The natural psychology of spiritual bliss. Piti pasadhi samadhi. Moving, gradually settling, gradually becoming one. The more happiness and contentment and tranquility there is in the mind, the more it is able to become unified, to become one. This is what samadhi means. It's like the composure of the mind, the coalescence of the mind. So we've seen that in all of the groups of the enlightenment factors, the bodhijangas that we've talked about so far, they all include this factor of samadhi. The only one that doesn't explicitly mention it is the four right efforts, where the four right efforts are like a distinct factor of the path compared with samadhi. But every other group includes the mention of samadhi in the four satipatthanas under contemplation of mind. Then it mentions samadhi in the four iddhipadas, mentions samadhi in the basic formula explaining each factor. Chandang nisaya labhati samadhi labhati citta sakyabhitam. Dependent on chanda, one gains samadhi, one gains one-pointedness of mind. The same in the five faculties, indriyas, the five balas, and these bodhijangas now, and in the eightfold path. Also mentions samadhi, every one of these sets. It's not an optional extra. It's not something which we can just sort of explain away or do without. And in all of these cases, when samadhi is further defined or further explained, it's always explained as being the four jhanas. Nothing else. No other explanations. No like alternative explanations. There's some different ways of putting the same thing. For example, in the enlightenment factors, it talks about samadhi with vitaka and vichara, and samadhi without vitaka and vichara. So obviously samadhi with vitaka and vichara is the first jhana, and then the without vitaka vichara is the other jhanas. And it's very obvious that that's what that means in the Pali. And if we still had any doubts about it, and we could simply refer to the Chinese version of the same sutta, which in fact does mention the four jhanas in that context. So when people tell you, you don't need to practice jhanas, just smile and nod and don't believe them. Because it's not the Buddha's teachings. Whatever they might say, this is not the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha's teachings is that you need to develop this samadhi as a natural, ordinary, essential part of the path, not as something which is like conceived as some great distant goal over there in some far land which I can never get and which is meant for others and not for me and all of this kind of rubbish. But it's just the evolution of the mind. It's the natural evolution of the mind. So as you practice, as you develop these factors, the mind will become peaceful. There will be a sense of rapture. There will be a sense of tranquility and happiness. These things will happen. They'll take their own good time. You can't rush them, but they will happen. And then from samadhi, the final one of these bodhisattvas is upekkha, is equanimity. So interesting how the equanimity is always like the last of the groups of dhammas. We see in the four Brahma Viharas, for example, equanimity is the final one. In the four jhanas, the fourth jhana is the one that's characterized by equanimity, and so on. And here too in the bodhisattvas, the final one is equanimity. Literally, upa means near to, upekkha. Ikkha is to watch, like to watch over something. That's what equanimity means. So equanimity isn't not caring about things, it's not ignoring things, it's watching over them. And this is something which is the outcome of the proper development of all the other factors. When we're thinking about equanimity in the Buddhist context, we need to clearly distinguish two aspects of this, otherwise we'll get confused. Okay, so what the first aspect is equanimity as in neutral feeling. So we know in Buddhism talks about three kinds of feeling: pleasant, painful, and neither pleasant nor painful. So this third feeling, neither pleasant nor painful, is also called in some contexts upekkha or equanimity. And so that's like a feeling, a tone, the tone of experience. But usually, or very commonly in these kinds of contexts, what we're talking about is upekkha, not as a feeling, but upekkha as an emotion. So normally it would be categorized in the Abhidhamma as part of the Sankhara Khanda, not as part of the Vedana Khanda. So as part of the Sankhara Khanda, if we accept that analysis, then we're talking about an emotional response to a feeling. And that reminds us of what I said earlier about piti, or rapture. And I think if we look at the jhana formulas, we can see that in fact this is what's intended. So first and second jhanas are characterized by piti as the emotional response to one's experience. The third jhana, and then especially the fourth jhana, are characterized by upekkha as the emotional response. So the difference between the second and third jhanas is that the second jhana, one has a pleasant feeling and one has an elation because of that pleasant feeling. And this is the piti. The third jhana, one still has a pleasant feeling, but there's no more elation about that. It's like a more mature emotional response. One has the equanimity towards that pleasant feeling. And then the fourth jhana, even the pleasant feeling itself has gone on, so it's like a twofold equanimity. Equanimity both as the feeling, neither pleasant nor pain, and as the emotional response to that feeling, as a sankhara. So here in the enlightenment factors, the equanimity of course is primarily that equanimity, the emotional equanimity. And since it follows after the development of samadhi, then we can understand that it primarily refers to the equanimity of the fourth jhana and higher states of samadhi. And also we can infer that it would be the equanimity which one would develop through insight practice as well. So in this case, equanimity would be like the emotional tone or attitude that one brings to insight practice. And this is probably one of the reasons why the fourth jhana is regarded as especially useful for insight practice, because it's based on that equanimity, which is very conducive to the arising of wisdom. One's emotions are not toned or coloured, it's very clear. And so one takes that equanimity that one's developed through samadhi, and you can develop the same equanimity for all the sense objects, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thoughts and so on in the mind. One also has the equanimity, neither pleased nor displeased, neither attracted nor repelled. And try to maintain this equanimity towards all of these factors is what called in Pali Chalangupekkha, the six-factored equanimity. And of course, when perfected, this is what we call the arahant, is one has that perfect equanimity towards all these things. So it is very interesting to notice that in these Bhujangas, like the path to enlightenment, there's so much emphasis on those samadhi factors, isn't there? Most of the factors seem to deal primarily with samadhi or jhana factors, certainly rapture, tranquility, samadhi, equanimity. All of these are like emotional qualities which are mainly emphasizing on the side of samadhi. Even energy, although it's not so obviously a samadhi factor, is also should be considered in that way because it's the energy that overcomes the hindrance of sloth and torpor. So in that case, it's what overcomes some of the obstacles to samadhi. So mindfulness is useful in both samadhi or samatha and vipassana, so it's like a neutral factor. And dhammavicaya, of course, is the wisdom factor or the vipassana aspect. So out of these seven enlightenment factors, actually five of them are mainly on the side of samatha. One of them is neutral, it's mindfulness, and one of them is on the side of vipassana. So it's like interesting to see this kind of emphasis in how the teachings are presented by the Buddha. How much importance that the Buddha gave to this emotional development, the development of like a whole, balanced, positive, emotional life, and so strongly recommended in these seven enlightenment factors. These are what lead to enlightenment, what lead to nirvana. So this is my little talk for this evening on the seven enlightenment factors, or factors of awakening. So I offer that to you for your reflection, and I'd like to open up if anyone has any questions or comments.
Why do you think that the life teachers do actually say, well, there's no need to practice? Do you have any insight into why they say that?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, it's obviously a very complex question. I think an important factor which we probably don't appreciate enough is simply the, which is actually a very simple historical fact, which is that every form of Buddhism which we encounter is a form of what we call modernist Buddhism. And essentially what that means in a Buddhist context is that every form of Buddhism which we see has in fact been largely shaped as a response to the whole colonial era. So when the Europeans went to Asia, there was obviously a great influx of Christian missionaries, and so Buddhism responded to that by developing modern forms of Buddhism which were quite consciously developed as a response to those challenges. And the Vipassana movement is one of those forms of modernist Buddhism. So it has, that's the agenda. Yeah? And if we look back in time, that was largely developed in Burma in the early part of the 20th century, is where when it emerged, probably at the end of the 19th century, and that's of course when Burma was colonized by England. And it's a bit difficult for us to relate to this idea, but one of the things which, from an Asian perspective, when the Europeans came there, they presented, well, we're rational, we're modern, all of these kinds of things, and part of that was Christianity. And that was perceived as being a kind of modern, rational religion. I realise from a Western perspective we don't quite see it in the same way, but that's how it was sold in the East and still is today. Yeah, and Buddhism was put down as being superstitious, old-fashioned, blah, blah, blah. So modernist Buddhism wanted to develop a style of Buddhism which is very rational and which was very logical and which didn't have superstitions. Wasn't involved with kind of magic and worship and all of these kinds of things. So the Buddhist traditions, all of them, started looking back at their roots, and it was actually a very healthy time for Buddhism because a lot of the time they realized, actually there's a lot of truth to that. Yeah, actually what a lot of us are doing as Buddhists is just sort of superstition and rituals and all of these kinds of things. And if you look at what the Buddha was actually teaching, it doesn't have a lot of those kinds of things. So in Burma, the specific form that took. Also, you have to understand, in traditional Buddhist cultures, meditation is always a bit suspect. Yeah? It's a bit kind of weird, and it's always kind of mixed up with all of these other things. Like, it's mixed up with ideas like black magic. you kind of do meditation so you can get some magical abilities. It's like a kind of shaman thing. Even in Thailand, before the time of Ajahn Mun, the forest monks always looked on as a bit kind of, you know, they're like the kind of the hippies of the Sangha, you know. They're kind of out there in the forest, and no one really knows what they're doing, and they're getting up to all this kind of weird stuff. And they're trying to get strange abilities. And again, a lot of the times that was true. A lot of times that's what people were actually doing. They were not really practicing Dharma. They were practicing to get some kind of magic abilities and things like that. And there was a lot of degeneration in that way. So because samadhi practice and samatha practice was associated in that culture and that time with these kinds of things, that was like a smear on the reputation of meditation as a whole. So then the agenda came to revive the interest in meditation in what was seen as being a very pure form of Buddhist meditation. That's why when you read the rhetoric of these kinds of schools, they're always emphasizing this, that this is like the original teachings, this is the pure, unadulterated teachings, blah, 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 blah. And this is like a very, very powerful piece of rhetoric which is repeated again and again. So because the samadhi side, samatha side, was tainted, then that was like sidelined, very marginalized, and that vipassana side was like held up. If you look at the teachings of the originators of those kind of systems, like Mahasi Sayadaw and things like that, then they still had a respect for samadhi and some kind of understanding of what it was. But they still, you know, were extremely polemical in their approach. And very often you find maybe their students who don't have such a good knowledge of Dhamma as they did, then take up those more extreme sides. And that, you know, sometimes you do find some very extreme things where people say, you know, don't even try to make your mind peaceful. It's good to have a scattered mind, yeah? And these kinds of things. And it's like dangerous to have a scattered, to have a peaceful mind. And these things are a bit, I mean, not just kind of incorrect, but a bit worrying if people people are thinking in these kinds of terms. And also another aspect of that is, of the reason is that also because of that, because in the traditional cultures, traditional Buddhist cultures, had so much emphasized the devotional side, giving dana, doing pujas, doing chanting, and so on. And they came from societies which were much more simple, pace of life is much slower, and so on. And less family breakup, I think, is a crucial thing. More of a strong sense of village identity, identifying with the temple and the village family. They tend to be more emotionally whole people. They tend to be happy people. And you've all seen that if you've been to Thailand and you've been to Burma and these countries, and you go to the villages, that's what people are like. They're kind of cheerful and much more together. They're not neurotic and stressed out like we tend to be. And so again, you can see there's actually a purpose in that context. There's a reason to say, well, hang on, you know, you guys, it's not just enough just to be happy and peaceful, but you've also got to investigate the Dhamma. So you can see there actually is a good purpose there to emphasize that aspect of wisdom and so on. So I think that aspect of the Vipassana movement is very good. Yeah, it's very strong, but unfortunately it got mixed up with this aspect of denigrating samadhi as well, which unfortunately is not very productive, especially when you try to teach the same system to people who are emotionally basket cases. Most of us are in the West. I'm not sure there's much more to it than that. That's just one aspect of it. That question is obviously a very complex and very interesting question. I've never seen anyone really look at it in detail. I've done quite a lot of work looking at the textual sources and so on. I haven't looked at the modern history in that much detail. Mm.
Because I remember asking Bhante Viratna once about jhanas and aspects of jhanas, and he said, from my memory, that basically, unless you spent years in a monastery, you would not be able to cultivate jhanas. So, as a lay person, you know, basically don't even know them.
Positive thinking, isn't it? I find that very surprising, because I know he teaches jhanas and samadhi to lay people quite frequently. And that's what he spends most of his time doing, is giving retreats for lay people and teaching anapanasati and so on. I mean, certainly practically speaking, yeah, I mean, it's true. For most lay people, they're not going to actually get jhanas.
Well, maybe he's talking about that for them.
Yeah. But, I mean, that doesn't mean that you can kind of dispense with them as part of the path. And certainly, that, I mean, that is something that's mentioned in modern times. Again, that's another kind of modern doctrine I've heard quite a few times, that because lay people aren't to make your mind peaceful, so better to do vipassana, but certainly it doesn't represent the position of the suttas. In fact, it's quite opposite. In the suttas, almost invariably, when the Buddha taught meditation to lay people, he taught samatha practices, almost invariably. And specifically the six recollections and the four Brahma Viharas, most commonly is what he taught to lay people as meditation. And very rarely do you find teachings of vipassana or anything like that to lay people. Sometimes you will, but much more rarely. Yeah. I mean, practically speaking, I think, yeah, it's true that for most people living in the world are not going to have that much chance of getting jhanas, although having said that, there are a reasonable amount who do, if they do have a chance to spend time on retreat or something. And there's also a few extraordinary people who make the rest of us feel very upset because they just sit there and the mind goes very peaceful and they get to jhanas and we feel very jealous about it and so on. There's a few people like that. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't develop those qualities, you know. That's what I find a bit puzzling about that kind of idea. It's got nothing to do with the fact of whether actually developing those qualities which lead to samadhi is a good thing. Yeah? And so that's the point, is it's not the point whether you get jhanas or not, it's irrelevant really. It happens or it doesn't happen, you can't control it. But what you can do is try to develop those wholesome qualities. Do it really consistently and deeply, yeah.
Certainly, there is some sort of underlying feel of like in the Nasi system, steering away from jhana, and don't go there, it's some sort of. It's sort of get attached to some of it. Definitely.
Talk about, you know, again, like many of these things, there's some truth in those kinds of ideas, and you know, from a sort of comparative perspective, normally, you know, you would think that, say, the great Hindu sages or great sages from other religions also practice, get jhanic experiences, and then take that to be a vision of God or a vision of the self or whatever they may take it to be. And yes, and they get attached to it, and because of the attachment, they get reborn in the Brahma realms. Still not too wrong with that. In fact, it's pretty good. But from a Buddhist perspective, then that's like a potential which is recognized. But it's important to remember that is not, it's not something which is created by the practice of jhanas or the experience of samadhi. Yeah, it's actually something which is inherent in all of us. Yeah? Inherently, it's part of our attachment to being and to being reborn and to experiencing bliss. And all of us actually having the feeling, yeah, it would be really nice if life was just like a realm of bliss and light and we were just to float around in these clouds of lovely glowing bliss and just live with all these other wonderful beings who are just floating around in these experience of bliss and light, never to have any hatred or anger or anything like that, and wouldn't that be wonderful? Yeah, everyone would like to live in a place like that. So that's like a feeling or a desire. It's like part of our religious or spiritual impulse. It's like we have an intuition of this kind of state of being, and of course, this kind of intuition is conditioned by the fact that we've been there. Yeah, all of us have actually been. We practiced jhanas in our past lives, and we've all been reborn in these spheres. We've all been radiant devas who have just spent countless millions of years floating through the sky and just blissing out on the light and all these kinds of things. Yeah? we've all been there, and in us there's this feeling of wanting to return to that as part of who we are. So that, yeah, that's real. So we need to investigate that like anything else. That needs to be something which we can take up and see. Part of our practice is to look at that and to experience that, to realize it, to investigate it, and to go beyond it. So when the Buddha addressed this question in suttas like, say, the Uddesa Vibhanga Sutta, actually, that was given by Mahakachayana, a commentary on one of the Buddha's sayings, if I remember rightly. And it says, you know, a certain person practices jhana, gets into samadhi, and then their mind follows after that bliss and gets attached there and gets like stuck in the bliss of that experience. And so that's how, I think he's used a term like get stuck, inwardly stuck. I think that's the term, something like that. So there's like a phrase of the Buddha where it says you should neither be stuck inside or scattered outside or something like that. And so Mahakachayana explains what it means. So getting stuck inside was getting stuck on these feelings. Getting scattered outside, of course, is being scattered by the sense experience. So these are the two extremes that you need to avoid. And so to overcome this being stuck inside, then you develop insight into that experience of samadhi. So when you have that experience, instead of letting the mind just indulge in that, so when you come out of jhana, instead of thinking, oh, how can I get back there, then you contemplate it as impermanent. You realize that experience was gone. Before that, I had this sense experience, eyes, sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. This was my world of experience. And then I went into this other place where there was this bliss and light. There wasn't those things. And now I've come out again. So you see this impermanence of those kinds of things, and you can see how they're relative to each other. So if you develop insight in this way, then that leads to, that's how you get over that attachment to them. I mean, it's true. Ajahn Brahm does emphasize the samadhi side very greatly, and obviously, as his student, I'm quite influenced by that. And there's a number of reasons for that. One is simply Ajahn Brahm's pig-headedness, that if everybody else is teaching vipassana, then he's going to teach samatha. So that's just sheer pig-headedness. We don't need to look any further than that. Another aspect, obviously, is his own experience. It's been a very important part of his own understanding. And I think he hasn't, in my memory, he hasn't spoken directly about this, but I understand, or I recall being told by somebody else, or by Ajahn Brahm himself, that in his early years as a monk, he had some experiences where his mind was like going into samadhi, or he felt that he was, you know, developing it or moving towards it or something like that. But because he'd been told, don't get attached to it, be afraid of it, this is dangerous, then he like turned his mind away from it and wasted a lot of time because he had this kind of idea which he picked up from around him, from some of the other teachers that were around at that time. Not from Ajahn Chah, but from some of the Western teachers, as I understand. So I think he felt that he'd been a bit ripped off. But again, I just should repeat that's not, I haven't heard that directly from Ajahn Brahm himself, but that's what I heard somebody else told me. So maybe that's another reason. And I think also an important reason is what I mentioned before, and Ajahn Brahm's mentioned this in his talks, is that, for this audience, for an audience of largely people from Western or from a modern background, then that tends to be our problem. Our problem is emotional dislocation, and so it's putting ourselves together. Once we know how to do that, then actually developing insight and investigation is not difficult. It comes naturally for us. So if we're trained from a very early age to not take things for granted, to investigate and inquire. So So it's more like it's also a balancing thing. And certainly, you know, for myself, I mean, that's where I feel, you know, just responding to people in our society, whether, I mean, you say it's like a Western background, but it actually is like any modern background, any big city, whether you go to Thailand or any of these places, it's the same thing, you know, you still see the same problems and family breakups and social pressures and the pace of change and all of these things. And that's what I see, is just with people again and again and again, and see that's what they need, you know? That's really what they need, is a feeling of peace, a feeling of joy and happiness, and that's the medicine for that disease that they have. So when I'm actually so worried about whether people get jhanas or not. It's just like what happens or doesn't happen, you know? But the main thing is that people sort of really address those emotional issues and do what they can to heal those things and create a sense of wholeness.